Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, November 19th. We're going to take a couple of articles off the front page of the Herald and Review that might be of interest this morning. The first is written by Valerie Wells, H&R staff writer. Johns Hill School draws support. And this is from Decatur. Tiffany Morse attended John Hill Magnet School in 7th and 8th grade, and she also went to school in the Stephen Decatur Middle School building during the time that Eisenhower High School was housed there during renovations. Her younger brother attends Johns Hill now. There are no windows, she said, of Stephen Decatur. It's dreary and not very bright and cold. Parents, staff, and a few students attended a meeting at Johns Hill on Wednesday for a discussion on building utilization in the Decatur District and how it might affect Johns Hill. The school board heard a presentation earlier this month from a consulting firm on options for district buildings. Among the choices was moving Johns Hill to Stephen Decatur. Johns Hill has the oldest and most expensive to maintain building in the district, and Stephen Decatur, originally built as a high school but converted to middle school in 1999, can house roughly three times as many students as it does now. The problem is that it's not set up for small children, and the metal partition walls don't contain noise, said Kim Miller, who is a teacher and a Johns Hill parent. You will hear every single classroom, she said. In a fine arts school, which is a large part of Johns Hill's programming, students are singing and dancing and playing musical instruments. Elementary classrooms, Miller said, should be active and noisy. Other options presented to the board and discussed on Wednesday by Johns Hill parents are consolidating both middle schools at Stephen Decatur, leaving the Thomas Jefferson Middle School building free for another use, possibly for Johns Hill. Moving both Montessori school programs into Stephen Decatur, freeing up those buildings, but displacing Stephen Decatur students who would have to move elsewhere, and doing nothing, which most attendees agreed is not a good choice. Several parents said they would like to see extensive renovation at Johns Hill because the hill is home. Problems that need to be addressed include a lack of parking, an office that's on the second floor, which decreases security, a shortage of storage, an aging facility, and no accessibility for those with mobility issues. The school board will hold another work session at 5:30 p.m. Thursday, December 3rd at Eisenhower. No decisions have been made. Our next article was written by Teresa Churchill, an H&R senior writer, and its headline reads, Freed Prisoner Extols Second Chance at Life. If a newborn had words to describe his or her birth, they would be the ones Angel Gonzalez would use to talk about the moment he learned DNA testing had proven he was innocent of the rape he had been convicted of committing in Waukegan, in 1994. It's like they shine light on you again, and you have a second chance at life, he said. I'm not a monster. I'm not a monster. What I had been telling for more than 20 years was true. Gonzalez, the eighth person freed from prison with help from the Illinois Innocence Project, spoke Wednesday evening to about 40 people brought together at First Presbyterian Church by the Macon County Criminal Justice Group, formerly known as Macon County Citizens Opposing Capital Punishment. Larry Golden, founding director of the project, helped tell Gonzalez's story and asked members of the criminal justice group for their continued support. He said he believes that a large number of exonerations will come from defendants who pleaded guilty to serious crimes, but now can go to court to seek DNA testing. Starting out in 2001 as the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project, the organization changed its name about the time the U.S. Department of Justice began providing funding in 2011. The project also began freeing an increasing number of prisoners who had been wrongfully convicted. Golden said Gonzalez, the most recent such person, was the inspiration for a new initiative to address the barriers Latinos face, including language, citizenship, and status. Among the project's current cases are its efforts on behalf of three people convicted in the 1996 death of Karen Hearn Slover of Decatur, but no mention of that was made Wednesday. Instead, the meeting focused on Gonzalez and how he was convicted on the basis of a victim misidentification and a signed confession written in English that the Mexican immigrant could not read. Asked by Dick Fiala of Decatur if he had heard from the woman he was accused of raping, Gonzalez replied that he had not and that he sees her, like himself, as a victim of the system. Gonzalez and Golden talked about the cruel reality that because he was proven innocent, Gonzalez is not eligible for the assistance prison parolees can get to help smooth their reentry into society. It is hard, Gonzalez said. There should be something in place, either through the Innocence Project or the community where you're from, but there's nothing. Out of prison since March, Gonzalez said he still marvels at how much has changed in 20 years, how many choices grocery stores and restaurant menus offer, and how his siblings got married and went on with their lives. He said representatives of the Innocence Project in New York, who also worked on his case, gave him a cell phone and went home without giving him any pointers. The next day, the phone started ringing, and I had no clue what to do, Gonzalez said. There was nobody around me to say, you do this and push it here. If you're interested in the Macon County Criminal Justice Group, it meets apparently at 6:30, the third Wednesday of the month, at the Central Christian Church, 650 West William Street in Decatur, and you can find more about the group on Facebook. Our next article was written by Allison Petty, an H&R staff writer, and carries the headline, Tilly is Lone Wolf No Longer. An unconventional companionship is bringing happier days to two animals, thanks to the ingenuity and efforts of workers at Scoville Zoo. Since her pack mate, Mowgli, died unexpectedly in April 2014, Tilly the wolf has lived alone. Zookeepers did their best to provide more interaction, but they noticed clear signs of depression. Moodiness, testiness, acting out with people she previously liked. Some days were worse than others, said zookeeper Mindy Weaver. No wolf pups were likely to become available anytime soon from Wolf Park, the Indiana wildlife facility that provides the zoo with hand-raised wolves. Workers there suggested finding a large dog to live next door to Tilly and keep her company, Zoo Director Ken Fry said. Enter Timber, a 90-pound mixed breed whose origin could include Husky or Alaskan Malamute, but who bears an unmistakable resemblance to a wolf. Excuse me. An intact male, Timber is estimated to be 18 months to 2 years old. When zoo officials heard about him, Timber had been living at the Wayne County Humane Society shelter for 3 months. He was relinquished by previous owners who could no longer care for him, said Amanda Klein, shelter manager and animal control officer. Employees quickly grew fond of the very lovable laid-back dog, Klein said. But the shelter, which frequently operates well over capacity, was no place for him. When the zoo contacted the shelter about adoption, it sounded like a great fit. Even though we miss him like crazy, it's better for him to be somewhere where he can run and be free, Klein said. And so, Timber came to live at the zoo on July 29th and moved to the pen next to Tilly in September after a quarantine period. There are countless wild smells to explore, plenty of room to run, and a steady stream of attention from keepers. The dog and wolf can touch and sniff each other through a fence, often running together alongside of it. Tilly has shown no signs of aggression toward her new neighbor. I think she feels like she's got a friend, Weaver said. Zoo officials hope to try uniting Timber and Tilly in the same enclosure eventually, but they want to be as certain as possible that it will be safe for both animals. Wolf pups are born knowing how to submit to a dominant wolf, Fry said, and there's no way to know whether Timber will have the same instincts. We want it to go well, and we don't want him to get hurt in the process, because she would want to definitely dominate him once they go in there, he said. Fry said a wolf pup or two might become available to Scoville next summer. If that happens, the zoo will seek a new home for Timber. Keepers are working with him now on skills, such as wearing a leash, which he doesn't like. But Timber needs no help learning to love people. He bounds excitedly toward visitors, leaping up on them and sometimes flopping over for belly rubs. I think they're both happier, Weaver said. I think he's in a way better place, and I think she feels like she's not just alone. There's some marvelous pictures in the paper showing the two animals and their various keepers and handlers. Let's hope it works out to be a good friendship. We're turning now inside the Decatur Herald and Review and pick up this article from Allison Petty, Drone Rules for Parks to be Studied. The use of unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones, in local parks is being considered by the Decatur Park District Board. Chief Park Ranger Ed Culp brought the issue to the board Wednesday because of concerns about the possible criminal use of the devices, as well as potential that the park district could face liability if someone were injured by one. My concern is a sex offender being off property, having one of those over some kids in the park or at dance class or anywhere, he said. The devices have become easy to obtain, he added, and are even sold in convenience stores. Oh my goodness. Culp said the board could consider banning the devices altogether in public parks or could require users to obtain a special permit. That would allow the use of the devices for activities such as photographing weddings and other events, he said. Park District Executive Director Bill Clevenger said the district is in the initial stages of developing a strategy for addressing the growing number of drones and their varied potential uses. District staff will consult with the Decatur Police Department and Macon County Sheriff's Office, he said, and will bring a recommendation to the board in the future. Culp said the colder months are the prime season to address the issue and have a policy in place for the spring and summer months when the parks fill up with children. We've got to protect our patrons, he said. Specifically, we've got to protect our youth visiting our parks. They need to feel secure. We're thinking outside the box a little bit, I understand that, but I'm looking at worst-case scenario with these. In other business, the board approved the district's capital priorities for the coming year, though several commissioners said they wanted to keep a close eye on individual expenditures as they arise. Chief Financial Officer Rodney Burr said 90% of the work would concentrate on maintenance and replacement of existing items, including roofs and roads that park district leaders previously identified as a priority. There's very minimal new items in here, he said. Ryan Voiles writes an article with the headline, Home for Holiday Adoption Program Offers Holiday Tryout. Holiday tradition has returned to provide a better time for families and the presents themselves. The Macon County Animal Control and Care Center and the Macon County Animal Shelter Foundation are conducting the 7th annual Home for the Holidays program, which offers deals on all the animals at the center through the end of the year. Additionally, people also can apply for foster care, which would allow them to host the animal without any upfront costs. Those who foster an animal for the holiday season have until January 8th, at which point they can adopt them or return them to the shelter. Adoptions during the event will be $40, or half of the initial cost. There are roughly 81 cats and 56 dogs available at the shelter. With the chance to foster an animal for a few months during the holiday season, Shirley Stanley said it is a perfect time for those who are undecided to bring home an animal. It's a no-brainer when you really think about it, said Stanley, president of the foundation. When you're thinking of introducing a new animal, the holidays give them a chance to interact with a wide range of people and develop familiarity with the family. Launched in 2009, the Holiday Foster Program has grown every year. Well, the first year saw just 12 adoptions. Adoption coordinator Amanda Fisher said they had about 130 animals go out to families last year, with 100 of those animals being adopted. I would love if we could beat last year's numbers, but we're just happy when the animal can be taken out of the shelter for a bit and be taken care of during the holidays, Fisher said. Since this year's event began earlier this month, Fisher said they have had about 13 animals go out to homes, with 5 adoptions being recorded. The program is also a chance to help those animals that have been at the shelter for a long time. Those include Samba, a pit bull mix that has been at the shelter since February. She's very friendly and she plays well with others, Fisher said. On the other side of the shelter, officials are hopeful to find a home for Rosemary, a one-year-old muted calico cat, that has been at the shelter since April. See, she's unique looking and being so small, I thought she would get adopted really quickly, Fisher said. For those on the fence about adoptions, Stanley emphasized the January 8 deadline for foster families to make a decision on adopting an animal. There is a bailout for people, Stanley said. Instead of thinking, should I or should I not adopt, they can take the animal home and try it out. We're going to look at the briefs. A3 briefs, it's a kind of a column they have every day with just some brief announcements and notices that the community might want to hear about. First is Miller Memorial Service, a memorial service for J. Roger Miller, Millikan University's longest-serving president, will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, November 21st, in Westminster Presbyterian Church at 1360 West Main Street. Miller, 88, died on October 14th in his home in Durham, North Carolina. The Reverend Arvid Adl, a Presbyterian minister and retired professor of philosophy at Millikan, will officiate. Speakers will include Patrick White, the university's current president, and Miller's son, Charles. Dr. Stephen Huss, an elder and trustee of Westminster and trustee emeritus of Millikan, will read scriptures chosen by the family. The University Choir and E. Dolan Woodwind Quintet will also perform. A reception will follow the service at Millikan University's Alumni and Development Center, 1305 West Main Street in Decatur. gun theft charges. A 50-year-old Decatur man was arraigned Monday on a felony theft charge for allegedly stealing four firearms from a Harristown household. A witness reported to police that someone had broken into a locked closet on or about November 1st in a home in the 200 block of South Joint Road. A box containing about $100 in coins also had been taken. During questioning by police, the man allegedly admitted to stealing the change, but not the guns. The man is being held in jail on $30,000 bond, pending his preliminary hearing December 2nd. Whitmer Lane reduction. The 1500 block of Whitmer Street between South 16th Street and South Stone Street will be reduced to one lane from 2 p.m. today, Thursday, until 3 p.m. Tuesday, November 24th, for water service repairs. St. Teresa High School Principal Ken Hendrickson will reduce his hours to part-time during a transition to retirement over the next few years. Assistant Principal Larry Daly will take over as principal, and Tim Brilly will take over Daly's position as Assistant Principal and Dean of Students. Hendrickson will turn 65 this month and said that he still plans to be a presence at school events and continue overseeing fundraising, budget, and personnel, while Daly will be responsible for day-to-day operations of the school. I think that's it for those notices. Now we turn to issue that will affect us. Springfield. This comes from Springfield, written by Kurt Erickson, the bureau chief for the Herald and Review in Springfield. State sets police body camera plan. Illinois is taking another step in the nationwide rush to equip police officers with body cameras. In response to a law going into effect on January 1st, officials are seeking a company to supply 1,000 body cameras and 1,000 patrol car cameras to state and local law enforcement agencies. The bidding process comes as police-worn cameras have jumped in popularity after events such as the police shootings of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Illinois State Police spokesman Matt Borwinkle said the bidding process does not mean the agency is on track to purchase the cameras. Rather, he said it will set up a framework for buying them in the future. This joint purchasing contract does not obligate ISP to purchase body cameras, but puts the contract in place if and when the agency is ready to initiate a pilot program, Borwinkle said. Companies are showing interest in becoming a supplier to the state. According to the Illinois Department of Central Management Services, representatives of 10 firms were present at an October 29 pre-bid meeting. Under legislation approved by Governor Bruce Rauner in August, a state law enforcement board is responsible for creating policy for using the equipment that can be adopted by agencies throughout the state. The new law doesn't... The law also provides funding for those agencies that decide to equip officers with the recording devices. A $5 traffic ticket fee will fund grants for these purposes. Of that, $2 will go toward camera purchases and $3 will go to training. The new law doesn't solely focus on body cameras. Police departments also will be required to use outside investigators for any police-involved shooting, report crime statistics to a statewide database, and increase their monitoring of use of force incidents. The House approved the measure on a 107-3 vote, and the Senate voted 45-5 in favor. The sponsor of body camera legislation said the potential purchase is a good sign. I think it's a positive step, said State Senator Kwame Raoul, a Democrat of Chicago. This gives us a greater chance of being cost-efficient. Meredith Krantz, a spokeswoman for the state's main purchasing agency, said the total cost for the equipment is estimated at $5.6 million over 2 years. Rule said the $5 fee and the possibility of getting a reduced cost by buying the cameras in bulk could tamp down concerns voiced by local police that the addition of body cameras to an officer's uniform is another case of state passing along costs to cities and counties. Formal bids for the purchase were due last week. Krantz, however, said a date for awarding the contract has not been determined. Our next article is an AP Wire story out of Hartford, Connecticut. Lenders taking more borrowers to court over student loans. Fall behind on your student loans these days, and you could end up getting more than hectoring phone calls and threatening letters. Some lenders are taking more people to court, attorneys say. The number of lawsuits filed over delinquent student loans that were made by private lenders has increased significantly in the past 2 years, lawyers told the Associated Press, even though borrowers are missing payments much less often than they did during the height of the recession. While no one tracks exactly how many such lawsuits are brought, an AP review of court websites in several states found several thousand, an overwhelming number of them filed since 2013. I'm seeing it steadily getting worse, said Joshua R.I. Cohen, a lawyer representing people in student loan cases in Connecticut and Vermont. They're going to court more often. They're pushing for harder settlement terms. Loan industry officials did not return calls or would not comment on the apparent uptick in lawsuits. Among those who have been sued are Cohen's clients Brett and Jennifer Reinhardt of Manchester, Connecticut, EduCap Incorporated, a major lender and loan administrator, took them to court in August on behalf of HSBC Bank, saying they owe nearly $59,000 on a student loan taken out by Jennifer, a teacher who earned a master's in education. The two sides have yet to come to terms on a repayment plan. I was angry, said Brett Reinhardt, who with his wife is raising two children. We had been willing to work with them the whole time. They wanted to play hardball. It's been very stressful. It's a big question mark looming over our heads. EduCap officials didn't return messages seeking comment. A lawyer representing EduCap in the case against the Reinhardts declined to comment. The lawsuits come as the student loan industry finds itself under government scrutiny over complaints about such things as paperwork errors and deceptive collection tactics. Well, it's time for us to take a quick break, and then we will return with a second half of news from the Decatur area. This is Ruth McCauley. I'll be waiting here patiently for your return and look forward to continuing our reading.